From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A naval showdown between China and the U.S. may be shaping up over Washington's opposition to Beijing's island construction project in the South China Sea. Beijing said that the islands it's building in the South China Sea are China's proper sovereign territory and that it considers the waters within 12 miles of them to be its territorial waters. The U.S. rejects that claim and, according to some media reports, is planning to sail a military patrol closer than 12 miles from at least one of the islands. Statements by senior officials in Washington and Beijing over the past few days did not contradict the possibility of a confrontation over the issue. This was U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby at his daily press conference Wednesday.
What we said all along is that the U.S. military, and Secretary Carter talked about this yesterday, will fly, will sail, and will operate wherever it needs to in accordance with international law to protect our national security interests and the interests of our allies and partners, period. How that's done, where that's done, when that's done, that's all for the Defense Department to speak to. What we've also said is that we want to see the reclamation activity stop, the militarization of some of those reclaimed features stop. None of that's doing anything to help reduce tensions in the South China Sea.
China has denied that its island building project militarizes the area. China's foreign ministry spokesperson Hua Chongying said Wednesday that if anyone is militarizing the South China Sea, it's not China.
It is necessary to point out that some countries deploy a large number of offensive weapons in regions far from their territories, which is the most important factor in the militarization of the waters. We expect that the related countries can stop hyping the South China Sea issue, abide by their commitment of taking no position on territory sovereignty, speak and act cautiously, respect the efforts that China and relevant states in the region have devoted to safeguard the peace and stability of the South China Sea, and play a constructive role for the cause.
Five new countries have been elected to non-permanent seats on the UN Security Council. Egypt, Japan, Senegal, Ukraine, and Uruguay were elected Thursday to take up two-year positions on the council starting in January of next year. All five ran unopposed and will now join the other five non-permanent nations currently serving on the council, as well as the five permanent members. Veronica Reeves has more.
Although a seat on the Security Council is coveted by many countries due to the prestige and influence it holds, some 68 nations have never sat on the 15-member body. Jan Bhatnaru, director of the General Assembly Affairs Division, explains why.
To become member of the Security Council, you need to have an agenda, you need to have a program, you need to have resources to build a team, to get information. If you are a small state and you don't have embassies covering most sensitive areas, especially conflict areas, it will be very difficult for that delegation to follow with their responsibilities within the Security Council.
The new members will join the other non-permanent members on the council, including Angola, Malaysia, New Zealand, Spain, and Venezuela. But the real power lies with the permanent members, China, France, Russia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, which can veto any issue that comes before the council. Veronica Reeves, United Nations.
Information technology should focus less on business and more on civil society. That, according to IT academic Professor Nicholas Negroponte, as he addressed the UN's major telecom conference earlier this week. Speaking at the opening of the International Telecommunication Union's Telecom World 2015, Negroponte said he thought connectivity should be free around the world. The ITU is the UN's specialized agency for information and communications technologies, and delegates are gathering in Hungary from all over the world to discuss core issues affecting the IT industry. Negroponte told journalist Maximilian Jacobson Gonzalez what he thought about the theme of this year's event, Accelerating Innovation for the Common Good.
I think there's no question that connectivity in general has created both prosperity, wealth, helped education and learning, and, you know, in the poorest as well as the richest countries. I think that the theme of the ITU, to accelerate it, probably needs a little bit of a parenthesis after the word accelerate, to accelerate where normal market forces might not ordinarily accelerate. Because if you look at the landscape globally, the absence of connectivity is noticeably in poor countries and rural parts of richer countries. It's a natural fallout of market forces and what would make sense to develop as a business. And my thesis, which is what I came to this meeting to present, is to consider telecommunications as part of civil society, not just a corporate opportunity.
What's the most important advice that you would give as a mentor to budding ICT entrepreneurs?
Well, I've been involved with the startup economy for many years. I've funded over 60 startups personally, so I've been deeply involved with that. I give slightly different advice today because I think the startup economy has perhaps gone a little too far and is sucking a lot of the talent out, and you are getting the quick turns, the app, the this and that, and the percentage of students that go on to work on really hard, really long-term problems has gone down. And there's a deficit today for those that want to work on hard problems. So I'm actually pushing a little bit the other way, asking people to join civic society, to do NGOs, to address big problems, whether it's ITU-type problems, whether it's fusion, whether it's, you know, eliminating poverty. I mean, there are many things you could do that are part of global civic society that aren't just a startup or a small company.
What's your main message to participants here at ITU Telecom World?
Connectivity shouldn't be just affordable. It should be free. And it's not as if making more and more and more affordable gets you closer to free. There's a real jump in belief. And the analogy I use is if I came to you and you're a head of state and I say, I will provide education for all of your children, kindergarten through 12th grade, but it's going to be private education. And you say, no, that can't be. I can't let you do that. So that's okay, I have another idea. I'm going to charge half the children twice as much and give it free to the other half. You say, well, that's not quite right either. And then I say, well, I'm going to lower the price. And I think, and in the end, obviously price matters, whether it's being paid through taxes and government or whether it's being paid. Of course, the prices must come down as much as possible. But there is a point where something flips. And even if you don't call it a human right, which I happen to, at least it's a civic responsibility. And one thing about civics and human rights is they're free. And people have said loosely they think that connectivity should be a human right, and access to the internet is a human right, but they say that and they don't really realize that all human rights are free. And so you have to make that leap and believe, is it really part of our essence? And I think it is.
UN peacekeepers will remain in Haiti for another year following the UN Security Council's decision Thursday to extend the mandate of the UN Stabilization Mission in Haiti, or MINUSTAH, until October 15, 2016. That, at the Secretary General's recommended force levels of up to 2,370 troops and 2,061 police. Haiti was founded in 1802 after the first successful slave revolt in recorded human history. It has since endured one of the most aggressive campaigns of dominance and isolation ever recorded, that at the hands of the former European colonial powers and the United States. Professor Gerald Horn explored some of that tortured history in his most recent book, Confronting Black Jacobins, The United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. We spoke with him via Skype Thursday.
The book, obviously, is a takeoff on the 1930s tome by the Trinidadian intellectual C.L.R. James, who wrote The Black Jacobins, which remains a leading study signifying the importance of the Haitian Revolution in terms of this process that unfolded between 1791 and 1804, a successful revolt of enslaved Africans, not only ousting the French colonialists, but fighting off the Spanish, who also tried to subvert the revolutionary process, and also inflicting one of the more significant defeats ever inflicted upon the British Empire in the late 1790s, which in many ways, in my argument, helps to explain why abolition came to these shores, that is to say, the United States of America. What I'm suggesting is that if you look comparatively at the defeat of apartheid in the 20th century, you recognize there was not only a result of struggle in South Africa, it was also a result of an international struggle. The frontline states, Angola, Zambia, Tanzania, the socialist countries, particularly Cuba, which inflicted a stinging defeat on the apartheid forces in southern Angola in 1988, which totally upended the counter-revolutionary process spearheaded by apartheid. Therefore, I'm suggesting that in order to understand the abolition of slavery in the United States, it's not enough just to look at the internal process here in North America culminating in the U.S. Civil War, 1861 to 1865. You have to understand precipitating events, foremost amongst which was the Haitian Revolution, which caused the British to reconsider slavery because they feared justifiably that the successful Haitian revolutionaries might launch an invasion into neighboring Jamaica. And this helped to inject more abolitionism into the British body politic, forcing Britain to move towards abolition of slavery in the 1830s. In other words, what I'm suggesting is that the Haitian Revolution created a general crisis for the entire slave system that it can only be resolved with that system's collapse, which of course takes place in North America in 1861-1865.
Now, there's some interesting symmetry, which I'm sure you've noticed and probably even written about, between Haiti and its role within that, and Cuba and its role in the international system, and also the converse, the treatment of Haiti by the international community, particularly the United States, aside from France, and the treatment of Cuba.
Well, as you know, I published a book on Cuba last year, Race to Revolution, United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, which traces the torturous relationship between the mainland and the island between the 18th century and up to the Cuban Revolution of 1959. Speaking of the Cuban Revolution, it's striking that it took the United States from 1961, when relations were broken, up until 2014 for the United States to recognize that particular revolutionary process. Now, do the math. How many years is that? Let's see, 61 to 41, 55 years. It took from 1804 till 1862 for the United States to recognize the Haitian Revolution. So in that sense, you can say that a more bitter fight was fought against the Haitian Revolution than against the Cuban Revolution, as hard as that may be for some to believe. And of course, when the United States recognized the Haitian Revolution, it was in the midst of a U.S. Civil War when the United States was desperate for allies, because the Confederate States of America were on the march and there was a realistic prospect that they could overthrow the United States government so that they could continue in their fiendish scheme of perpetuating slavery. And Haiti was one of the few governments that extended full-throated support to the United States in its death match with slavery. Britain, which of course had a strong abolitionist movement, but that abolitionist movement was not necessarily in the halls of power in London, and British elites actually wanted to see a split of the United States, which made them rather ambivalent about giving full-throated support to the U.S. government based in Washington, D.C. And this Haiti support, in many ways, was even more ironic because part of my book talks about the splitting of the island of Hispaniola. If you look at your map, you'll see that the island of Hispaniola is the headquarters of two independent states, Haiti and the Dominican Republic. The The latter, the DR, comes into existence in 1844, and as I try to suggest, the coming to existence of the DR was a result of one of the first and most successful, quote-unquote, covert actions of the U.S. authorities under slave-owning Secretary of State John C. Calhoun, who helped to engineer the split of the island because of fear of Haitian Black Jacobins and their anti-slavery gospel, which was then antithetical to the slave-owning mania of the United States of America. And it's very striking to note as well that after the island was split and murderous conflict erupted between Haiti and the DR, there was a real danger then that the United States would then annex the entire island. In fact, in 1870, 1871, when the book concludes, the United States comes within a whisper of annexing the entire island of Hispaniola and then shipping a good deal of the so-called U.S. Negro population to that island. So it's only by something slightly less than a miracle that a person of African descent like myself is still residing here on the U.S. mainland.
And actually, some additional arithmetic. Next month, it'll be 212 years since the decisive battle that kicked the French out of Haiti. And, you know, it's only Haiti is still really in a state of occupation by the United States, whether through the UN or whatever. Certainly the last independent government that Haiti had was removed by the United States. So, you know, almost 200 years later and continuing to 212 years later.
Well, as you know, during the World War I era, approximately a century ago, the United States began an occupation of both Haiti and the Dominican Republic. It was something of a continuation of the attempt to annex both circa 1870, 1871. That occupation only ended in 1934, but as you correctly state, in recent years, there's been a de facto U.S. occupation of Haiti. Of course, there has been a plundering of Haiti that continues. You know that after the tragic earthquake of approximately 5 years ago, you had millions of dollars supposedly being poured into Haiti for reconstruction. But subsequent journalistic investigations have suggested that a good deal of that money was basically skimmed. And it seems to me that if there's any justice, there'll be criminal investigations and criminal prosecutions of those in the United States who were responsible for that malfeasance, that is to say, taking money that should have gone to the homeless and the hungry in Haiti and putting it into already bulging pockets.
And, you know, the United States, although it did everything it could to isolate Cuba and tried the invasion, you know, the Bay of Pigs invasion, numerous assassination attempts of the leadership, various wrecking operations, and in 1962, threatening it with nuclear annihilation, it has yet to occupy Cuba. Now, I understand the Soviet Union, a nuclear power, had protected it up until its disappearance from the world stage in 1991. But in the subsequent 24 years, even, the United States has not been able to plant its feet on Cuban soil, with the exception of Guantanamo, and occupy it. And yet they have kept a firm grip on Haiti since the island was divided back in the mid-19th century.
Well, as my book details, Haiti has fought a desperate battle ever since independence in 1804. There was the battle against the slave-owning empires, not only Britain and Spain and France, but also the United States of America. Nationalists from the United States of America, as they looked through the Americas, they saw Spanish territory initially, and they saw British territory, and they saw French territory. And the only territory that seemed that wasn't being dominated by European colonial powers was Haiti. And so that meant that Haiti was in the crosshairs, not only for being colonized by the United States in the first few decades of the 19th century, but a colonization that would lead to re-enslavement That is to say that it was a cardinal goal of many within the United States, speaking of Euro-American elites, to take over Haiti and then re-enslave the population. They make that explicit. And so it was a very difficult battle for Haiti to fight, even more difficult in some ways than Cuba in the 20th century, because as you suggested, in the 20th century, you had the disintegration of colonialism in Africa, you had the rise of a socialist camp, and that provided a kind of cover for the Cuban Revolution. Haiti was not so blessed. Matter of fact, to show you the desperation into which Haiti was thrust, one of its central allies actually was Britain, the British Empire. But it didn't have that many choices. It was a small country. It had a population during the era in which we're talking about of probably less than a million, perhaps even less than 750,000. And so it was very vulnerable. But yet, it still was able to attract many so-called U.S. Negroes who were fleeing persecution in North America. It's estimated by the 1820s that approximately 13,000 to 14,000 former U.S. Negroes had moved to the island of Hispaniola. And what's ironic is that they had moved to the northeastern side of the island, that is to say, part of the island that eventually became Dominican territory. And so when the island was split in 1844 and these former U.S. Negroes were on then Dominican soil, they were oftentimes perceived, perhaps correctly so, as being agents of Haiti, that is to say, agents of what was perceived to be the enemy, and therefore faced a certain persecution. And then, in a remarkable maneuver in about 1860, because the DR was under such pressure from Haiti, the DR government asked the colonizing power, Spain, to return, to recolonize the DR. It's remarkable that most countries in their history fight against colonialism, whereas the DR in circa 1860 asked to be colonized. And of course, that led to a conflict, a war in the DR, in which these former U.S. Negroes played a pivotal and instrumental role of fighting against the Spanish colonizers. But at the same time, they were still viewed as agents of Haiti, which did not necessarily benefit them once the DR became fully independent.
We're kind of still seeing that scenario play out now with the expulsion of Haitians from the DR.
Well, certainly, this is a continuation of a long-standing struggle. In fact, it was predicted in 1844 when the DR became independent that this would basically tie down these two countries indefinitely, because it makes logical sense for that one island to be one nation, just like it makes logical sense for Cuba, one island, to be one nation. And of course, there was discussion in Washington of trying to split Cuba at one time too, which of course would have thwarted that revolutionary process unfolding post-1959.
And Cuba, you mentioned the role that Cuba played in taking down the apartheid government in South Africa in the battles on on the side of Angola, and despite the efforts of the United States to contain the influence of Cuba over the recent the past decade and a half, really, its influence has really permeated the entire region with the rise of Venezuela and the Alba Bloc and CELAC and now even UNASUR. Castro, for example, both Fidel and Raul have a tremendous influence among even the non-socialist, at least economically non-socialist governments in Latin America. Is it possible that the growing solidarity among Latin American and Caribbean nations will see them at some point come to the aid of Haiti and let Haiti play its natural role in the international system?
Well, I think it's fair to say that CARICOM, the Caribbean Community Nations, that includes Jamaica, Barbados, etc., has been in solidarity with Haiti The problem is, of course, we're talking about small nations. The so-called superpower of the Anglophone Caribbean nation is Jamaica. It only has about a population of 2 million people.
Right.
Barbados only has a population of about 275,000, 280,000. So these are small nations that have their own dependencies to contend with. You might have noted that when Prime Minister David Cameron of Britain arrived in Jamaica just days ago, that he was petitioned repeatedly by Jamaican nationals with regard to the issue of reparations for slavery, for example. So these Caribbean nations have been doing their utmost, have been doing their best to try to assist Cuba, Haiti, just as Cuba has been as well. But right now, given the correlation of forces globally, where in this hemisphere at least, the United States still plays an instrumental role, where the only contestation to a degree has come from Brazil, which now is going through its own internal problems with the attempt to impeach Dilma Rousseff and the strength of the right in Brazil, particularly in the press, where the right wing is even stronger than the right wing in the press and the communications organs in the United States of America. And so this is the struggle and the battle we face today. But I think there's reasons to be optimistic because recent events have shown that U.S. imperialism is in decline. This is something that the right wing is finding it difficult to grapple with, which has helped to fuel the ascendancy of Donald Trump and Dr. Ben Carson and other right-wing insurgents, so-called. But irrespective of their being able to mobilize the so-called white right, the middle class and working class and ruling elite across class lines in Euro-American community, despite their efforts and despite their struggles, it's clear what the line of march with regard to history is. And it spells ill and it spells doom for U.S. imperialism, which simultaneously is good news for both the Cuban revolutionary process and the Haitian revolutionary process, which began to unfold in 1791.
And the, I mean, you can see some of the contradictions in Haiti on the ground, in fact, with the presence of Brazilian troops among the U.N. forces occupying the country. You know, looking at this change in the international climate and the rise of an alternate international system, of course, Brazil sits in a pivotal role. It's the Western Hemisphere nation state that's part of the BRICS, and there seems to be gravity towards that bloc on the global stage. So do you think that we might see something happening sooner rather than later in terms of some kind of assistance for Haiti?
Absolutely. And that's why I think it's possible to be optimistic. Now, of course, Haiti is going through some turmoil because of credible allegations put forward against President Martelly concerning corruption and manipulation of elections and all the rest. But in the grand scheme of things, and one has to view this from 30,000 feet, so to speak, I think it's possible to see that as a bump in the road and as a blip on the screen, because with the major force seeking to thwart Haiti being U.S. imperialism having one foot on a banana peel, it's possible to then tease out a scenario whereby Haiti will be able to regain its balance in the 21st century. And, of course, assisted by Cuba, assisted by forces in the Caribbean community, assisted by other progressive forces in the Americas, that it will be able to overcome.
Okay, Dr. Horn, thank you very much. A pleasure as always. What's the name of the book?
Confronting Black Jacobins, United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, Monthly Review Press, 2016. And just to flag this for the next few months, my next book, Paul Robeson, The Artist is Revolutionary, will be out in January.
Thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.